Okay, now we don't have quite that many people here, but I am going to call this meeting to order of the House Education Policy Committee. So if members could take their seats, and we'll wait, obviously, to move the minutes until we have a quorum. I know there's some committee members coming over here from the Capitol, so it may take a little bit of time. So what we have today is we just have an overview today on special education, because we're going to have a lot of special education bills before us about paperwork, talking about limiting it, talking about ways that we can provide the services more efficiently. So today is really our chance to learn. We're going to have the Department of Education up first. And since they're easily accessible for you to ask questions offline, I'd like to contain the amount of questions we ask the department so we could have more time to ask questions of those who are going to come before us that are the providers. So we're going to have some administrators here and some teachers that actually implement the IEPs and do stuff in the classroom, which I think you're going to find a lot more interesting to be able to ask them questions. So if we could limit our questions to MDE to stuff we can ask them offline and when we have bills before us, and really kind of focus on those that are coming before us that actually do this work in the classroom. So with that being said, why don't we have the Department of Education come down. We have Darren Corte, Robin Wiley, and Mary Kay Kanaga-Litzau, which you're going to have to all introduce yourselves to the record so I can also hear your names pronounced accurately. And they're here to present an overview on special education programming, in particular the requirements that are above the IDEA Act, the federal law, and the requirements that Minnesota has that are above the federal law. So it looks like they're getting their PowerPoint set up here. And I see two of the three of you here. So I'll let you introduce yourselves for the record, your titles, and then begin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Kay Kanaga-Litzau, and I'm the Director of Compliance and Assistance.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robin Woodley. I'm the Director of Special Education at the department. And Darren Cordy's on his way. He's our Assistant Commissioner, and he's running just a few minutes late. So he asks that we get going, if that's okay with you.
Thank you.
Well, we're super-duper excited to be with you today. Thank you for inviting us. We have just a short presentation for you. We wanted to make sure that we keep everything within 20 minutes, if at all possible, because you have some really great other presentations from school district staff and administrators coming later. So I'd love to just... Will you do this? You need to move it
right here?
Yeah. Yep. So here we go. We're all ready to go, and I will go over what we do within special education, also talk a little bit about the kids that are served in Minnesota, and then talk about some initiatives that we have in the at the department that hopefully help to address issues related to improved results for kids and also partnerships with districts and working in terms of positive behavioral outcomes. So first of all, the law that you have been hearing about a lot this session so far is called, related to special education, is called the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And once again, it's an act that's been around since 1975, and it is a piece of federal legislation that works to ensure that students with disabilities receive a free and appropriate public education that meets their unique needs. It was last reauthorized in 2004. I know that you've had a conversation in previous hearings and also on the finance side saying maybe that'll come up again and maybe it won't. We'll see how that works. There are certainly regulations that go along with the federal law to help us put the law requirements in place, and you see the citations there on the slide. Within the law, there are two sections, if you will, that relate to the services that states are required to provide and the funds that come to the state associated with those services. We have a Part B section to the law. The Part B section includes funding and guidelines for children with disabilities ages 3 through 21. Within that portion of the law, there are two sections of funding provisions. One is called Section 611 that is based on child count for kids ages 3 through 21, and then there is a Section 619 that is the preschool portion funding that comes to the state for kids ages 3 through 5 with disabilities. An accompanying piece in the law is the Part C section to the law, which is provided for infants and toddlers ages birth to 3 years of age that are disabled or at risk. As we think about the Part B services, that's where you'll talk about issues related to the Individualized Education Program, or the IEP. You've heard a lot about the IEP in multiple sessions and years if you're continuing members of this committee. Within that requirement, within Part B, we have requirements related to child find, eligibility, and development of this IEP, and Mary Kay we'll talk more about that later in our presentation. It's critical that you understand that FAPE, free appropriate public education, must be provided in the least restrictive environment, and sometimes this is also known as providing services in the most integrated setting. We also speak to, within Part B, instruction being provided to enable students with disabilities to be involved in and make progress in grade level curriculum, i.e., their own results and achievement. The other portion to the law relates to Part C, as I mentioned. Part C includes programming and services for infants and toddlers with disabilities and those infants and toddlers who are at risk, ages birth to age 3, and their families. And the family is a really important part to the programming included for infants and toddlers ages birth to 3. Doctors or parents generally make referrals to this program through the Help Me Grow Minnesota site. And the specific services for those eligible infants and toddlers are provided through another kind of plan called an Individualized Family Service Plan, or an IFSP. As you may know, there are 13 different categories that help us identify kids with disabilities here in Minnesota, ages birth through 21. We are a state, one of the five states, I think, in the country that continue to have a mandate for special education services down to birth. And the children are served either in the birth through two program, i.e., the Part C program, on an IFSP, as I mentioned before, or for kids ages 3 through 21, that would be in the Part B program on an IEP. I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking with you just a bit around some data, the counts of kids. As I said, we have 13 different categorical disabilities, and we often get asked what the percentage is of those different categories, so we've referenced that on this slide for you. I want you to note that this is taken from our 2018-2019 child count, and this does incorporate children, the child count for kids ages birth through 21. You'll note that the most frequent disability categories are those related to speech-specific learning disabilities, speech or language impaired, autism spectrum disorder, other health disabilities, developmental delay. Developmental delay is a category for children ages birth through 8. And I'll give you some more, I'll provide some more data in the next coming slides in terms of possible increases within those categories. This next slide, I would like you to note that this is the percent of K-12 enrollment. So we have some information in here for you related to ages birth through 21 and some regarding kindergarten through 12th grade. You will note that on this slide, includes special education child count for students, as I said, grades K through 12. It does not include birth through 5. You will see that special education has seen an increase of almost 13% in the last 5 years. Increases of over 3.5% in the same population have occurred in the past 2 years, while the general education enrollment has increased almost 2% in the last 5 years. Sometimes I get questions asked around how does it relate to general education enrollment, so I wanted you to have that included for you. If we look at the next slide, this slide also is one that relates to information for children ages birth through 21 across a number of years. And special education has seen an increase of 16,791 students in the last 5 years. If we go to the last slide in my part of the presentation, it's a slide that has a lot of information on it. I wanted you to see some trend lines, and I wanted you to see different counts within different categories. You will note that this is for children ages birth through 21. Once again, we get asked that question. The three disability designations that have seen the greatest number increase over the last 5 years are developmental delay at 3,394 in terms of a total N number count, or that is a 21% increase. Once again, that's for students ages birth through 8. Autism spectrum disorder has had a 20% increase over the past 5 years. Specific learning disabilities has had an increase of 14% over the past 5 years. Other disability designations with increases of more than 10% are emotional or behavioral disorder at 14% and other health disabilities at 10.5%. Interestingly enough, folks back at the department gave me, the folks that work on data within our division gave me this information regarding the category of disability category of deaf-blind, which is, while it is a really low number of children in our state who are eligible or they are in the deaf-blind category, they have seen the greatest percent increase over the past 5 years at 71%. Wow. So the count is very low, but the percent, if you look at that, it has increased dramatically. I wanted to give you just a bit of information regarding our special education division. There are multiple divisions at the Department of Education who work together to provide services and provide training and funding opportunities for kids with disabilities in schools. Within the division that I work with, we work to provide training, information, and resources, policy development, and technical assistance to districts and other stakeholders through lots of different kinds of projects and grants. And hopefully these activities will help districts, communities, and families with local planning and service delivery, program implementation, program evaluation, and problem solving around positive outcomes for students with disabilities and also improved results. One of the things that was asked of us was to talk about, or at least reference, what some of the key activities that we currently are involved in that help us to partner with districts, families, and other agencies to hopefully improve results for kids, and we've listed those there. If there are any that are of interest to you and you want to ask me more questions about them, I'm certainly happy to do that later. And last, the last slide in my part of the presentation relates to the various stakeholders that we have, that we work with across the department and certainly within the division that I'm honored to lead. I want you to note that we have multiple state agency partners that work with us to improve results for families and kids. We see you as a partner, certainly. We have many organizations that are represented in this room, as well as those that aren't here that work with schools and kids and families, and we're excited about that. And we certainly see students as one of our major stakeholders. So I think I have completed my portion in somewhat of a timely way, I hope, Madam Chair, and I can certainly stand for any questions. Did you want that, or do you want to continue?
Thank you, Ms. Feinberg. I think we have two quick questions. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for your presentation. You know, when I served on my school board for about 16 years, and I was a pretty strong opponent of labeling and drugging of children in special ed. You know, from the information I've looked at, other countries do not label and drug children nearly at the rate that we do. For instance, France, according to published information, labels and drugs about 0.5% of their student body. We in this country are at between 9% and 11%. In fact, the Star Tribune said that 10% of our K-12 student body has ADHD now in this state. You know, with the strong negative effects of psychotropic drugs on developing children, both recognized by our military and by the medical community, has the department have concern about the high level of labeling and drugging of our children and the negative effects of psychotropic drugs on developing children compared to what other countries are doing.
Representative Grünhagen, before I let her answer, we're trying to keep to the IEP section of this and get to the school administrators and teachers. So maybe a really brief answer, but this seems to be something that you could handle offline, maybe with the department. Ms. Litzau, Mr. Cordy, or Ms. Wadley, who would like to take that?
Madam Chair, Darren Cordy. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Education. Apologies for being late. The roads are not a lot of fun out there. But in terms of your question, Representative Grünhagen, you know, we have entrance and exit criteria for special education in our rules. That's specifically spelled out. Districts make that identification based on that criteria of whether or not a student is eligible for special education criteria, and we trust our educators and our administrators to do that evaluation and make prudent evaluations and identifications. So, you know, to the extent that treatment might or there might be other treatment associated with that, including, you know, the prescription of medication, you know, that would be up to the discretion of the district, the IEP team, and the parents.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Wadley, does the data now that you've covered cover more than the traditional district and charter schools? Would it also include non-public and private, our agency like at Faribault and Purpich, which is also a small agency, and our tribal contract schools? Does your data include all of those?
Ms. Wadley?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Erickson. Yes, it does.
Thank you. Very good.
Thank you. And then do you want to continue on with your presentation?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, Mary Kay Kanaga-Litzau. So I'm going to just go through quickly what are the components that are in an individualized education program or IEP. The slide on page 16 provides some context as to what is the purpose behind IDEA and providing an IEP to provide services to a student with a disability. And it's to ensure that students with disabilities have available to them a free and appropriate public education that emphasizes special education, which is specially designed instruction, and related services designed to meet the student's unique needs and prepare them so that when they graduate from school, they're able to go on with post-secondary education and or employment and independent living. The next slide is really just a resource for you to have. I've used it in a number of trainings, and it's a nice cycle of what is the process involved in special education during the time a student's receiving services. It starts with if there's child find or referral or a parent request for an evaluation. Evaluation report is completed. That information provides eligibility determination and what are the present levels of need that that student has that impacts their ability to access the general education curriculum. And then based on that, measurable goals and objectives are developed. And then there's progress that is regularly provided to the parents as to how the students are doing on the goals and objectives. And then that in turn, if there is not sufficient progress, there may be an IEP meeting or further evaluation. And then every year there is an IEP meeting. And so, again, we need to have an evaluation to determine that a student is eligible for special education. Disability categories are in the regulation, and then we have state rule criteria which set out how you determine that you meet the criteria to be eligible for special education. Parents and the district staff review the results. There's an evaluation report. And then at the same time, you can also have an IEP meeting, and that is actually recommended by the Office of Special Education Programs so that you at one time can both review the results and have your meeting for resources, saving resources for both district staff and for parents. When you have that IEP meeting, there's certain persons, people that need to be present, certain roles. One is the student's general education teacher, a student's special education teacher, an administrative designee, typically the principal, parent, and then others invited as appropriate, including the student. So basically, you need people with expertise on the general education curriculum, on being able to design specially designed instruction and help to design appropriate accommodations for a student, and then you need to have someone there who can commit district resources. The meeting needs to be scheduled in a mutually agreed upon time, so districts need to contact parents as soon as possible so that at least one parent can be present. So what are the different components that must be in an IEP? You need a description of the student's present levels of academic achievement and functional performance. That would include how are they doing it, like in reading, in mathematics, do they have behavioral issues, do they have functional needs that need to be addressed. How does that affect that student's involvement and progress in the general education curriculum? Based upon that information, measurable goal, annual goals, and short-term objectives or benchmarks are developed. The goal has to have a baseline, and then where are you going to end up in a year, and how are you going to achieve that? How it's achieved is often set out in the objectives of benchmarks. Those are steps to get there. And then with the goal that the student is making progress in the general ed curriculum. Progress reporting is another component that needs to be in the IEP. A description and when and how progress will be reported. That includes as often as it is for a non-disabled parent. So if there's quarterly report cards, you would send progress reporting on a quarterly basis. How is it going to be written? Are you often an annual IEP meeting counts as one of those progress reports? And then how will progress be measured? So who's going to be collecting information and so that you have a measurement of how the student is doing on their goals? And then finally, another component, that third bullet is describing what are the special education and related services that the student will receive. What is a specially designed instruction? And related services could include specialized transportation, speech language, occupational therapy, physical therapy. Those are different types of related services. And also, are there any supplementary aids and supports that the student needs to be able to make that progress? It could be modifications or accommodations. It could be a student might be taking a test in a different room, not having to answer all of the questions for homework, having a test read out loud. There's a variety of different ways that it could occur. Least restrictive environment, Robin Woodley talked about that. How often will the student not be with their non-disabled peers in the general education curriculum, in their classes, extracurricular activities, and non-academic activities? That would include recess, lunch, sports. And then when are the services projected to begin? Their frequency, location, and duration. So how often is the student going to be receiving the services? Is it every day, twice a week, once a month? And what are the number of minutes per session? And where will it take place? Will it be in the general education classroom, or will it be in a special education room? In addition, the IEP needs to address if the student needs any accommodations on statewide or district assessments, and if they're unable to take a state or district-wide assessment, why, and what is an appropriate test for them to take. And finally, that when a student is 17, that they are notified that within a year when they turn 18 that the rights of a parent are transferred to them. And transition services are also another piece of the IEP to be provided starting in grade 9 to produce a results-oriented IEP process. The purpose of transition is developing the post-secondary goals and objectives to assist that student so that they will be able to be successful either with post-secondary education, training, employment, and independent living as appropriate. And again, it's based upon the child's needs. And then when that IEP is completed, a prior written notice is developed, and then it's sent to the parent with the proposed IEP, and then they have the opportunity to object or consent to that IEP. Okay. So that is the conclusion to the IEP process, and then the next portion of my presentation is on how we exceed in Minnesota, but are there any questions on the first part?
Yes, Representative Kunesh-Bodin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. Could you tell us an example, or what would you say is the average timeline from when a student is maybe identified or thought to have some sort of issue where they might need to be on an IEP? So from that initial
recognition that something, this child needs some help and it might be beneficial to be on an IEP. Once that identified, what are the steps and how long does that usually take for them to get to the end of a workable IEP plan?
Madam Chair, so when a student is referred for services, generally there's pre-referral interventions that take place for a period of time, which are evidence-based practices developed with a special education teacher that take place in the general ed curriculum. And if a parent requests an evaluation, then typically the district will go forward with that evaluation. So once the parent consents to an evaluation plan, which sets out what are all the testing and assessment, what records will be reviewed, the district has 30 school days from the date the parent either consents, and that you need to consent to an initial evaluation, or 14 days pass for a reevaluation. Then the district has 30 school days to complete it, and then typically there isn't a specified time period except for an initial evaluation for when the IEP meeting happens, which is 30 days. However, typically I would say probably 2 to 3 weeks between the time the evaluation is completed, the evaluation meeting, and then the IEP team meeting.
Thank you. Representative Kunesh-Patin, is this maybe better directed to the administrators and teachers that we're going to come forward to talk through timeline, or is it for MDE?
No, it might be better for the next.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, Representative Goonhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, thanks for the presentation. Just one more question for the department, and I don't know whoever wants to answer it, is, you know, the OLA report in 2013 on special ed recommended that since we have about 170 regulations and mandates over and above the federal requirement, that we should evaluate them as in terms of cost and effectiveness in the special ed regulations, which, as far as I know, it hasn't been done. Has the department taken a look at that OLA report, and are you planning or are you doing evaluation of the 170 regulations and laws above the federal requirement for cost and effectiveness?
Mr. Corte, I know that's the next part of your presentation, but if you want to briefly answer that.
Sure. Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen, we did and do an analysis of where the state exceeds federal regulations every year in terms of the cost. That, I mean, there's no that was not something that the legislature asked us to do at that point. It was part of the OLA recommendations to the legislature. We've had discussions about that. We did have a special education work group that was pulled together after that, which looked at how the state rules align with the state statutes, and some changes were made in that respect. But I think the kind of comprehensive analysis that was looking for there would require resources that we don't have.
Thank you, Mr. Corte. I think this is a good segue into the next portion of your presentation. If ever members look at the packet, there's a 29-page little memo about all the areas where we fell above the federal government. That was scintillating reading last night for me, so go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. So there, it's called the Section 608 Memorandum, which is a handout. And it highlights, and I'm going to go through that to highlight the areas in which Minnesota statutes and rules exceed federal requirements. As context, when IDEA was reauthorized in 2004, the Office of Special Education Programs at the U.S. Department of Education stated that states could provide services beyond the federal regulations, and the 2004 did change a number of the regulations from 1999. But that if states chose to do that, then they needed to submit a memorandum describing how the state exceeds those guidelines, federal requirements. And that document is called the 608 Memorandum, and we submit that every year with our state application for federal Part B special education funds and post it on the MDE website. So I'm going to highlight just a few of the areas in which you may be seeing legislation, and we'll be hearing from others, other districts, regarding areas that they would like you to look at. One of those is prior written notice. IDEA provides that notice must be provided within a reasonable amount of time before an action goes into effect. Minnesota has codified that as 14 calendar days. I don't know whether that is considered exceeding or not, but we always include that in our memorandum. IDEA provides that a district can't override an initial evaluation or IEP. Minnesota goes a step further by saying that a district cannot override a parent's objection to a reevaluation. In addition, the prior written notice sets forth a conciliation conference requirement. That is not found in federal law. It's akin to the resolution meeting that's required for due process hearings. It's a type of alternative dispute resolution process where relevant district staff and the parent meet to try to resolve areas of objection. And under IDEA, all states must offer mediation as an alternative dispute resolution. So Minnesota exceeds by requiring districts to both hold a conciliation conference unless a parent refuses, or to offer facilitated team meetings, which is where we have a facilitator assist the district and the parents if they both choose to participate in that process. The next area that I'd like to talk about is non-public schools. So students who attend non-public schools are entitled to FAPE under state statutes, and that's on pages 13 and 14 of the 608 memo. So we have two statutes, 125A.03 and 125A.18, which have been looked at both by the Minnesota Court of Appeals and the Federal Eighth Circuit Court, and they've issued decisions that consistently say that these two statutes confer an individual right to FAPE to students enrolled in non-public schools in Minnesota. This exceeds the federal requirement, which does not confer that individual right to students who are parentally placed in private schools. The next area that I'd like to talk about are IDEA elements that exceed the federal requirements. These are rules and a statute, and they have the language that was in the 1999 IDEA. The timing of transition services is one of those areas. So in Minnesota, we say that transition services, so it needs to be included in the IEP during grade 9. And the federal law provides that not later than the first IEP to be in effect when the student turns 16 or younger if determined appropriate by the IEP team. I would like to note that Minnesota Statute Section 120B.125 does require districts to provide transition planning for all students during grade 9. And then the last piece that I wanted to cover was benchmarks and short-term objectives, which are on page 25. So the Minnesota rule contains the language that was found in IDEA again back in 1999, which provided that all IEPs must include short-term objectives or benchmarks. In 2004, when IDEA was revised, that language was changed that benchmarks and or short-term objectives are only required if a student has been determined in need of taking an alternative statewide or district assessment. And that concludes my review of the 608 memo. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Thank you, Ms. Kaniga-Litzel. It is actually, I made a joke saying it was scintillating, but actually was a really good overview of where we are above to lay the groundwork for the discussions we're going to be having for the bills ahead of us. So I'd really encourage folks to look at it, and it takes a little bit of time to digest, but thank you for providing it. Is there any other quick questions before we bring the administrators down? All right. So thank you so much. Oh, sorry, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe this is to Mr. Corte. Will the governor include any of these recommendations in the agency bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, to be determined. I think the governor has been clear that special education, in particular the cross subsidy, has been a priority for him. But in terms of what's actually going to be in the budget, that's not something I have information about right now.
Still a secret?
It hasn't made it to my level yet, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Corte. While you're moving out and the administrators are coming down, we have a quorum, so we're going to do the minutes real quick. Has anybody had a chance to review them? Representative Kunesh-Podin?
Yes, I move that we approve the minutes from January 30th, 2019.
Thank you, Representative Kunesh Bodine moves approval of the minutes for the Wednesday, January 30th, 2019 meeting. Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Erickson.
Madam Chair, this is not a correction or an addition, but more or less a correction to some testimony that was given during the Future Assessment Design Working Group that I wanted on the record. As you recall, I asked a question about, or maybe made a statement, that teachers are involved in the writing of the item questions, and the reply from MDE, from their government liaison, was, yes, indeed, for math and reading, item question writers may be Minnesota educators. The technical document that I read said former teachers, but now currently for the science, they are Minnesota teachers or educators. If they write the questions, they do not serve on the review panel for the grades or subjects that they wrote for. And in the past, some writers or passage finders were Minnesota educators, and once upon a time, I was any and all of these. And then when we set the cut scores, those are definitely teachers and others who are invited to do that. So just to make sure that when the testimony is listened to, that there's a correction to that question that I asked, that Minnesota educators are involved in item question writing. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Erickson. And we actually will be delving into the standards discussion next week when we have some folks coming in presenting how that process goes. So we're back on the minutes, and Representative Kunesh Bodine has moved approval, and we've had discussion. Any more discussion? So those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes for the Wednesday, January 30th meeting are approved. And now before us, we have a presentation from Special Education Administrators. We have Jamie Nord and Nicole Woodward. Could you please state your names for the record and where you're from, and then you can begin the presentation.
Madam Chair and fellow committee members, my name is Jamie Nord. I'm the Executive Director for the St. Croix River Education District.
And Madam Chair and fellow committee members, my name is Nicole Woodward, and I am the Director of Special Education for the St. Croix River Education District.
We greatly appreciate your commitment to learning more about special education through your committee meetings this year, and welcome any additional questions outside of our 20 minutes today. But we're tasked with giving you an overview of the identification and IEP process, and to share with you a little bit about some potential solutions to the challenges that we're facing across the state of Minnesota. Just to give you an idea of where Nicole and I come from, the education district that we support serves six school districts going up Highway 35 out of the metro. So we represent Chisago Lakes, North Branch, Rush City, Pine City, Hinckley, Finlayson, and East Central, and we also provide support to the Trio Wolf Creek Charter School. As mentioned, we are representing the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education today, which is our professional organization. In our time together, we are going to be providing an introduction to the basics in special education, looking at the processes as well as the timelines associated with those, using a tale of two students to walk you through the people, the paperwork, and the process involved in each of those steps, and then briefly touching on challenges and potential solutions. So digging into the identification and IEP process, you have two different handouts. The first handout describes the linear process for initial special education evaluations, from the time that we begin pre-referral interventions with a student through the time of their comprehensive initial evaluation. I'm not going to go into great detail into these steps. Nicole, as she walks you through the tale of two students, will be touching on these, and I think by using case study students, we're able to illustrate what this actually looks like in the trenches. The second handout is a more circular process, and this is an ongoing process once a student has been identified as a student with disabilities that's in need of special education services. So they met initial qualification criteria. The team works on developing an IEP for that student. The IEP is then implemented. We're tracking progress for that student, making adjustments to their programming along the way. And then at minimum, we have to conduct a comprehensive reevaluation every 3 years or as student needs warrant. Also in your packet, you have a handout that has special education timelines listed at the top. This is a tool that we actually use with case managers in our districts as a handy reference to help them keep track of all of the different timelines associated with special education due process paperwork. So as you can see from this handout, there are a lot of timelines. Some of these are per state law. Others we follow federal law on. The timelines vary in terms of the days. So some are based off calendar days and some are on school days, which also can become confusing when you're trying to track all of the timelines. This is just showing you for one individual student the timelines a case manager would need to track. But in most of our districts across the state, there are on an average 20 students per caseload. So multiply these timelines by 20, and that's what they're trying to keep track of for all of the students that they serve on their caseload.
Madam Chair and fellow committee members, we'd like to spend the next several minutes telling you a story because although the identification and IEP development process can be explained procedurally, it is best told through a story that illustrates what this looks like in real time, as well as some of the challenges that teams face when they're completing these pieces. So please meet Sunny and Stella. As you can see, Sunny and Stella are both sixth graders, but each are enrolled in different school districts, one property rich and the other property poor. The fiscal resources available in each district vary and result in different instructional opportunities for these students. And so if you read their profiles, what you can see is both students have unique and wonderful strengths, but also demonstrate challenges in the area of reading. So when we look at Sunny, due to budget reductions in Sunny's district, the intervention program has been eliminated. This first step that we're talking about is the step of pre-referral intervention. As mentioned by our partners in the department, before a student can receive special education, we need to consider and implement pre-referral interventions. And so we use our existing resources within the general ed setting to do that. Unfortunate for Sunny, those interventions have been cut. So Sunny's classroom teacher, still needing to meet this requirement, works in collaboration with the school psychologist and attempts to implement several strategies that facilitate improvement in Sunny's behavior and reading performance. Sunny continues to struggle and disengages from academic instruction. Sunny's teacher shares her concerns about Sunny's behavior and reading with her parents at conferences. In contrast, Stella has a sixth grade team that reviews grade level data regularly and identifies her as a student in need of support. She's placed in supplemental small group evidence-based reading interventions and Check and Connect, which is an evidence-based behavior intervention. An evidence-based practice is any practice that the effectiveness is supported through empirical and objective evidence, such as educational research or metrics of school, teacher, or student performance. Stella begins making significant progress in her reading skills as a result, and this has a positive impact on her behavior and academic engagement. Stella's teacher reviews her progress with her parents at conferences. So that's pre-referral intervention. The next step for both of these students is the consideration of a referral for special education. So for Sunny, growing increasingly concerned with their child's reading difficulties as well as behavior difficulties, Sunny's parents decide that they want to request a special education evaluation. And any parent has the right to do that at any time. Sunny's parents put this request in writing, which is listed here as a requirement, but although they don't have to actually write that request, they can verbally share that with the district, and we need to respond to that as well. In response, the school team holds an initial evaluation planning meeting, so they gather people together to sit down, consider the parents' request, look at the data available on the student, and put together a plan that would address those concerns. Because of the concerns, the school says we can continue to implement some strategies to support Sunny, but parents persist. They're gravely concerned, and they waive that pre-referral requirement, and the district can move forward with an evaluation at that time. Stella, on the other hand, is making great progress. Her parents are pleased, and they decide to continue on as is. The behavior intervention that she's been receiving is working and doesn't need to be continued because her reading has excelled to the point that she's now willingly engaged in her instruction. So no special education evaluation is requested in Stella's case. And for the purposes of this illustration, her story has now ended. For Sunny, we are moving forward with an evaluation. So once that team meets to consider that request by parents and put together a plan, that's that step. And now we need to move forward with consent. Because even though the parents have said this is what we want, the district still needs to obtain their consent in writing before they can move forward with the evaluation for an initial evaluation. When it comes to initials, parents have as much time as they want to consider that evaluation, and so we work with them in that process, answer questions, resolve any kind of concerns or disputes that they have. Listed here on this slide, you can see that when we get into each step of this process, we're not only talking process, but we're talking people, we're talking paperwork, and we're talking process. And I think it's important to understand all three. When it comes to consent, we're involving parents, the case manager, and the entire evaluation team. Parents have to review an evaluation plan document as well as a prior written notice document that explains that plan, and there's a form that they can sign. And then as soon as we get that, we have to respond to the request in a reasonable amount of time, and so we do that, and then that paperwork gets sent home. In this case, Sunny's parents have provided consent in writing to the initial evaluation, and as soon as we receive that, our 30 school day clock starts ticking and the team gets to move forward. The next step in the process, once we're going, is conducting that initial evaluation, and again, we involve all the different people in the building that have a say, have knowledge of the student, have expertise in these areas. And so, and that includes the parents. Parents are part of an evaluation. We collect information from them. A case manager kind of facilitates the entire process. And then there's an evaluation team that can serve, provide, or include several professionals, including school psychologists, licensed teachers in different disability areas of those 13 described earlier. In this case, we're also involving a school nurse, and then also the general education teacher because we need that perspective as well. In terms of paperwork, various assessment tools are completed, and all of that data, those results, are compiled into a comprehensive evaluation report that includes several required components by law. Those are listed for your review there. Again, that team has 30 school days to complete that entire evaluation, synthesize, analyze, summarize those results, and then review those results with the team. Typically, this occurs in a team meeting. Based on the evaluation results in Sunny's case, the team determines that Sunny meets initial eligibility criteria in the category of specific learning disability, otherwise referred to as SLD. Please note that this category is the one that typically captures our students who struggle in the area of reading, in this case, or mathematics, or written expression. But for reading challenges, when we're looking at kids who are significantly below their peers, and these challenges may be related to dyslexia, including students with significant deficits in basic reading skills, reading fluency, and reading comprehension. So it's important to note that not all students who have dyslexia need special education services, but if they did have dyslexia and were demonstrating this level of need, this is typically where they would be captured. So now that the team has determined this eligibility, they have 30 calendar days from the date the decision is made to develop Sunny's IEP, or Individualized Education Program. In terms of this step, IEP development, again, several people are included. The parents, a special ed teacher licensed in the student's disability, in this case SLD, a general ed teacher, a qualified district representative or administrator, and because Sunny is experiencing behavior concerns, also a behavior service provider would be required. These are the minimum required attendees at an IEP meeting, but they can include more depending on the case. For the paperwork here, we have to produce a notice of team meeting to all parties. We have to draft the IEP itself, provide a prior written notice, and again, parents have the option to consent or not provide their consent to a proposed IEP. So we have that meeting, and then the IEP is sent home within a reasonable time frame for parents to review and provide their consent. The IEP includes several required components, including present levels of academic achievement and functional performance. How are they doing? What does it look like? goals, objectives, and services. For Sunny, this includes services in the area of reading and behavior. It also includes accommodations and modifications to give them access to their general ed curriculum as well, because we need to make sure they're educated in the least restrictive environment and have as much access as possible to general ed curriculum. Paraprofessional support is also included in this plan. So Sunny's parents are given the plan for review, and they provide consent to the initial IEP proposed by the district. And now the real work starts. And this following step, we implement the IEP as written. This is a legal document, and so we have to uphold it to the letter that it is written. The people that are responsible for implementing an IEP include the case manager, all special ed service providers, general education teachers, and any paraprofessionals that might be providing those services as well. For the IEP, the paperwork includes that document itself, progress monitoring activities and documents, progress reports, a determination of extended school year if a student needs to get services into the summer once school has ended for the year, and possibly any amendment paperwork, because sometimes IEPs need to be changed once they were initially written based on how a student is progressing. In Sunny's case, Sunny is struggling. Sunny is not making the progress that we expected when we wrote that IEP. So the team comes back together to create a new plan, to change the plan, again, redo the paperwork, and provide that notice to parents. We go in that cycle annually until at most 3 years following the initial evaluation, where we have to do a comprehensive re-evaluation to look at Sunny's level of need and say, does Sunny still require special education? Is the program working? How is Sunny doing? Have new needs emerged? Have other needs gone away? And how will we proceed? And so we do that. A different piece to note here from the initial evaluation is while we put together the same type of evaluation plan, we provide a prior written notice to parents and give an opportunity for consent, we don't have to receive their written consent at this point. If parents don't respond one way or the other to us within 14 days of receiving that notice, the district is allowed to proceed with the plan. We call that passive or implied consent because they didn't disagree with us. If they do disagree with us, then we hold a conciliation conference, as you've heard about. It's an area that we exceed federal, which from our perspective is a good strategy that we have, because at the district level, a lot of times we're able to use those conciliation conferences to resolve any disputes that we have with parents and prevent any further difficulties or disagreements. So in this case, Sunny is up for re-evaluation. And as Sunny's team proceeds through this re-evaluation, they attend to some new re-evaluation requirements that they learned through monitoring training. So we have to go as a district through monitoring, compliance monitoring with the State Department. And at those trainings, when we're up for monitoring, oftentimes we learn of new requirements or new interpretations of requirements. And in this case, Sunny's team learned about a new requirement that they need to now include a statement that addresses any additions and modifications that might be needed. If Sunny's IEP program is not working, we have to make an explicit statement in the evaluation report that speaks to that. This statement is in addition to the changes that are made in the IEP, any prior written notices that go out explaining that change, and any agreement to amend forms that might be provided. And the table on the following slide outlines some of those changes that might be made and the difference between our previous practice and current. Once the re-evaluation is completed, the district has to review and revise Sunny's IEP. So we have to look at the data that was collected through that process and then look at the current IEP and decide, based on this information, is this plan appropriate or does it need to be changed? Most of the time, those IEPs are changed in response to a re-evaluation. And so with this, the district reviews the re-evaluation, they change the IEP accordingly, they outline all of those changes specifically within that document, and then they draft a prior written notice outlining all proposed changes since the last IEP. As with the re-evaluation, Sunny's parents have 14 days to consider this proposal, and they can either say that they do not agree, they can provide their consent, or they can say nothing, and the district will proceed accordingly. The prior written notice is one area to really highlight that has changed in terms of requirements over the year. The State Department spoke to this in their presentation as well. Previously, the table that you'll find on this slide kind of shows you the requirements in the past and the requirements now, and just the difference in the amount of information that we need to include in a prior written notice. In terms of paperwork reduction, this is one area that the State Department has reduced our paperwork in terms of what we are monitored on. So we're no longer monitored for compliance with prior written notice. However, we're still held to the requirements for the prior written notice document. And oftentimes it's what's within this document or without in complaints that get districts in trouble or that we are ending up needing to address. So therefore, the Sunny's case manager in this case is very diligent in ensuring that there is perfect alignment between Sunny's IEP and her prior written notice. Again, both legal documents that this teacher is compliant with. We're experiencing some technical difficulties. Please hold.
We do have the slides in front of us if you just want to keep going.
Yeah, absolutely. I can keep going. So why is this story of Sunny and Stella important? It illustrates to you in a very real way what the identification and IEP development process looks like in our current system. Stories like those of Sunny and Stella occur in our schools every day, but are often far more complex than what is illustrated for you here today. Still, these stories showcase the hard and important work our special educators do to meet the letter of the law while also meeting the educational needs of students with disabilities. Furthermore, these stories highlight the challenges teams face throughout the process, challenges with paperwork and process, and challenges with the availability of resources that make the federally mandated requirement to offer an IEP that is reasonably calculated to enable a child to make progress appropriate in light of their unique circumstances that much more difficult.
We really wanted to bring to you today not just the challenges that we're facing in the field of special education, but just touch on some potential solutions that as an organization we're supporting. We did put together a slide that shows just an overview of the challenges and potential solutions. If you're interested in learning more about any of these potential solutions, we'd be happy to visit more with you at a later date. But just to touch briefly on the challenges and solutions listed there. The challenge in many of our schools is that special education is the only solution for struggling learners. When schools lack a comprehensive intervention structure like we saw in the Tale of Two Students to address academic and behavior needs at all prevention levels, a higher number of students are referred for special education services like Sunny in our stories. This results in an increased special education staffing and resource allocation. A potential solution to this is to support the implementation of a multi-tiered system of supports, otherwise known as MTSS. Please feel free to reach out to us if you would like to learn more about that potential solution. We would also be remiss if we didn't mention the challenge of special education paperwork requirements in our testimony today. Current MDE interpretation requires more than what is required by state or federal law. In preparing for our presentation, we reviewed the proposed bills resulting from the new ALM proposal, which addresses where Minnesota exceeds federal requirements for special education paperwork in several areas. While some of the proposed changes will certainly help with the paperwork demands, we are reaching a crisis point as it relates to encouraging new and keeping our current teachers and staff in the special education profession. Currently, it's all about having documentation so that when you are monitored or go through a complaint or due process hearing, you're able to defend yourself through paperwork. We welcome any effort to reduce the paperwork burden without negatively impacting the delivery of special education services to our students. Please encourage the department to keep these concerns in mind whenever they promulgate rules. In addition to the challenge of paperwork requirements, the focus for accountability coming from the state is on paperwork, not results of our students with disabilities. As I'm sure you are well aware, we have a significant achievement gap in special education, and until the pendulum swings in the direction of focusing on improving instruction to improve results instead of on paperwork, we are not going to see improved outcomes for our special education students. As a result, special educators' prep time is being used for paperwork, not prepping for high-quality instruction, and the professional learning that we as administrators provide to our special educators is focused highly on paperwork the majority of the time. The solution here is to shift the accountability focus to results. I would like to point out that MDE has been looking into making this shift, for which we are very grateful. They've been looking at this with other state departments, and we applaud and encourage their efforts in moving in this direction. As a parent, wouldn't you want your student's special education case manager to be focusing on your child's response to specially designed instruction? And if he or she is not making progress, be using data to make decisions regarding what type of instructional change is needed to continue to help your child continue to grow? Or would you rather have your child's case manager ensuring that they have crossed all their T's and dotted all their I's on your child's evaluation report and IEP that is sitting in the student's cumulative file in the school psychologist's office? For the record, we do not think that special education paperwork is not needed to document students' needs and service plans. It has its purpose to provide procedural safeguards for our students with disabilities. But the level of scrutiny that the paperwork is facing these days at the department exceeds its value, and the time educators spend on paperwork would be much better spent working with our students. In closing, I would like to point out that there is no other facet in public education of which educational practitioners, teachers, are asked to create a document that can withstand a legal challenge. Teachers should teach. They are not attorneys and shouldn't be spending their valuable time laboring over documentation in an effort to meet such high legal standards when we have students with disabilities who desperately need our high-quality instruction. Madam Chair and fellow committee members, we sincerely thank you for your time this afternoon and interest in this important topic. On this slide, we've included our contact information, as well as John Klaber, the Executive Director of MACE, if you're interested in reaching out to him. He was unable to join us today due to weather. We hope that anytime special education is being discussed, either in the Education Policy or Finance Committees, that you would call on MACE as a resource. We're happy to engage in conversation and to visit anytime. At this time, we'd welcome questions from the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Nord and Ms. Woodward. That was a tale of two students. It was wonderful. Thanks. Representative Baker.
Madam Chair, thank you. It was a great presentation with the tale of two students. And again, I want to say that I'm new to the committee. I'm new to this issue in this kind of a depth. And I've heard of this so much back in my district about the paperwork. So thank you for kind of spelling it out for me this way. So, again, being new, I've got a couple questions about maybe what MDE was talking about earlier, and if you can answer this, great. If you can't, maybe we'll call them up later. So a lot of timelines, a lot of guardrails about how to help our kids. I think that sounds really good. Mm-hmm. Tell me, with all the extra requirements above and beyond federal requirements, the 608 booklet here, and also tell me, with all the timelines, again, if we're getting results, I want to continue this, baby. If we're not, then how do we compare with other neighboring states? How do we compare with special education to other of our neighbors? I think that's important for us as business owners and employers and educators. I want to know, how do we then compare with our current tight-knit, tight guardrail system? Can you help me with that?
Whichever one of you would like to take it? Ms. Nord, I see you.
Madam Chair and fellow committee members, I am not going to be able to answer that fully today. I think that it's definitely worth taking a look at what other states' outcomes look like for their students with disabilities, and comparing the paperwork requirements across states. That isn't something that I've engaged in personally to be able to speak to that, but I definitely think you raise a really good question.
Representative Baker, follow up?
Thank you. And I think, and again, we may have some really good results from this. But I also want to make sure that we are giving our kiddos the best outcome as possible, that we can give them the best chances of actually getting off of special ed and getting into the mainstream. Mm-hmm. And the other question I was going to have was, and again, I'd like to have a follow-up with somebody like you from ACE to have a further conversation. But how long does a typical student, and again, we heard earlier that we're talking to the kids 0 to 5, mm-hmm. and we were before they get to this, you know, public schools. Are we seeing better results of getting our kids off of special ed if we've touched them before school? And again, this might be an education question, but I'm just kind of curious, if we're getting to them sooner, are we getting better results so we see maybe less kids stay on the programs longer, so we can get rid of all these other timelines that we have to kind of continue with the child and so on? So any thoughts on that?
Go ahead, Ms. Woodward, really quickly. I want to try to stick with the paperwork issue and stuff too, so go ahead.
Yeah, I can speak to that, Madam Chair and fellow committee members. I can speak to that briefly. Being able to serve students birth through age 5 initially is a really important tool that we have, and we can serve students on a category called developmental delay up through the age of 7. And a lot of students who receive services in that category do not need services later on. There are less pre-referral intervention requirements for students birth through age 7. It's all about early intervention. Students ages birth through 3, it's all about working with their families and their homes to give them skills to support their children better. And so that opportunity to serve students that young does help us get students kind of in, get them the support they need. And several students are dismissed out of that category before getting what we affectionately call a big kid label, if you will, in real terms, but another categorical disability label over the age of 7, you know, as kids 8 through 21. But once they qualify 8 through 21, I don't have specific data to give you, but students do tend to stay on longer once they're qualified in that age range.
Thank you. And I have quite a few people for questions, but I also want to get to the teachers, so I'm going to focus on the folks who haven't had a chance to ask questions before. So, Representative Mariani.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to be very, very quick. I have two questions. We don't have to dive deep in them. One, Madam Chair, I might ask this question for Mr. Heller, who sent me a note. The MTSS system, it seems to me, would be an appropriate system in working effectively with students with print disabilities and twice exceptional. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and fellow committee members, yes. The MTSS system has a lot of research behind it, but it's actually a better system to be using for a lot of our students that typically fall through the cracks. So including ELL students, all English language learner students, it meets the need for all students. I'd love to chat more about that.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So my second question, and you don't need to go deep because, you know, time is of the essence here. We can do offline. But it seems to me in the years that I've been here that we've taken elements of what you've identified as some of the challenges here and have attempted to legislate kind of in a silo way. So, for instance, we, a number of years ago, did some major, you know, reform changes, approaches to paperwork, to the paperwork component here. It seems to me that all these pieces are interconnected here. To focus on paperwork, which is really part of a process, doesn't speak about the rest of the process, doesn't speak necessarily about some of the legal requirements that get created either statutorily or through case law, mm-hmm. doesn't talk about the regulatory, you know, rulemaking, decision-making of the department. So it seems like a really big thing that at times we try to come at in, you know, by through a silo approach. So the question really is several, but one right now, does this come down to, this won't be fair, does this come down to deregulation, does it come down to funding, does it come down to a big redesign of our approach? I mean, if things work, they work, and so why aren't we doing them? You know, often one of the reasons we don't do perhaps new things is because there aren't the resources there that we're providing directly to make happen.
Representative Mirani, I think that's a very large question to answer here. So maybe one sentence so I can get to two other people here. Maybe
Madam three. Chair and fellow committee members, it is a very large question that I would love to chat more about. I do feel like part of the issue is those siloed programs. If we could approach it from a more comprehensive, systematic way, I think that we could see some increased outcomes for our students.
That's good enough for now.
I think that's a very good answer, actually. Representative Hassan? Representative Herr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a really quick question. And this is sort of a follow-up to Representative Baker's question around outcome that I'm just curious. I mean, some kids will, you know, do better and come off of the IEP plan no longer and need be part of SPED. But I'm wondering, do you track that outcome by, like racial and cultural demographics to see, like, which particular groups are actually doing better and actually you know, that you're seeing better results with, and do we track the data in that way? And I'm wondering if sometimes the paperwork is just to sort of try to force certain results, and I don't know, maybe you don't have an answer to that, but just thought I would ask.
I see heads nodding, Ms. Woodward.
Madam Chair and fellow committee members, we do track a lot of our data by demographic, you know, cultural differences, English language learners, free reduced lunch. I mean, we look at all of those populations. We look at it in terms of identification. And so we can be really sensitive to whether we're over-identifying in a certain group or not. We look at it in terms of their academic outcomes, in terms of their test scores that they're achieving, and if we have discrepancies there. We don't track data very well for when we exit students and who we're exiting. That's not something that we look at. We do look at that through MARS. But it's not something that I can speak to specifically.
We would be able to pull that information from the MARS system because those demographic areas are included with each individual student, and at the time that they're exited from special education, they do receive a different code within there. So I believe that the department would be able to provide that information.
Great. Representative Erda, I want to make sure we also get the teachers down here who drove through the snow. So do you have a quick question?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I may have gotten my answer from Representative Mariani, but I'm a little confused. Maybe someone else can answer. But a few years ago, when Representative Sawatsky was here, we did pass a bill to reduce the paperwork for special education. And apparently we restored it last year, and I'm trying to figure out if that's true or what happened on that. Does someone?
Madam Chair and fellow committee members, I believe that was dealing with the statewide IEP system.
Mm-hmm. I'm seeing nodding from the audience from the group that's coming down next. So thank you, Ms. Nord, Ms. Woodward.
Thank you so much for your time today.
And then I why don't we keep the next presentation of the teachers to about 10 minutes if we can, so we can leave some time for questions, but we can go a few minutes over because I don't think anybody hits the room right after us. So coming down right now, we have got Amy Aho and Heather Matthews to give us a presentation of what this looks like in the classroom and implementing it as a teacher. Go ahead, introduce yourselves for the record, and continue with your presentation.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Heather Matthews. I'm a special education elementary teacher in the District 196, which is Rosemont, Apple Valley, Eagan.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Amy Aho, and I'm a speech-language pathologist in the Brainerd School District.
So I will begin, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the invitation to talk with you today. I have been teaching in District 196 for the past 26 years in the same building as a special education resource teacher. I have had the opportunity to teach students in all disability categories from kindergarten to fifth grade. I went into education because I love working with students. I love helping them to overcome emotional and social challenges to succeed beyond what their parents thought was possible. Special ed paperwork should be a tool to drive instruction and to ensure that students with disabilities get the services that they need. I am concerned about special education paperwork in Minnesota because it has gotten to the point where it does not improve instruction, but it takes away time to prepare for our students. My job responsibilities have changed dramatically in the last 10 to 15 years. When I first started teaching, my day consisted of teaching reading, math, written expression, with about 18 kids on my caseload, and the majority of those being specific learning disabilities. I have had time throughout my day to service their academic needs. I was responsible for a handful of assessments throughout the year. Today, my job looks different. The recommended caseload in my district for a special education resource teacher is 16 students. I currently have 21 and growing. Most of my students have autism spectrum disorder, ASD, or emotional behavior disorder, EBD. Their needs are emotional, social, and behavioral in nature, and they require more time out of the classroom for breaks, social skills instruction, behavioral assistance, on top of academic instruction. Consequently, the paperwork requirements for these students are more in-depth and comprehensive in nature. The time to complete paperwork. Teachers get 50 minutes of prep per day, and that is supposed to be used for curriculum preparation for our students. This time is crucial for preparing rich lessons for our students. Due to paperwork being federally mandated, legal ramifications will happen if they were not completed correctly and within the timelines that you heard earlier today. The reality is there is not enough time in the school day to prepare lessons and complete the required paperwork. All teachers have work outside of their duty day, and we acknowledge that. While I know many of my general education colleagues face this, I want to help you understand the complexity of the paperwork. Here's one recent example of an assessment report that was written in my school for a second grade student. I just brought an example of it. It's 47 pages long. This is one assessment report, and it took 73 hours to complete. And that there was two people assessing, the school psychologist and a special education resource teacher like myself. 73 hours. This is one student and one assessment, and as you know, we have many assessments that go on throughout the school year. Now, each assessment is different, as each child is different with different needs, but one thing is consistent. We as special education teachers spend too much time doing paperwork and less time preparing lessons and teaching our students, which is what we love and need to do. We are facing a retention and recruitment issue with special education teachers. I have a handout that I think that you have passed out to you that shows a survey that was given to teachers, and this shows the top two frustrating parts of paperwork are the redundancy and the time taken away from students. Special education teachers are dealing with large amounts of stress. Some of the stresses are the stress of completing all of their paperwork within those timelines, the stress of creating resources to meet the needs of all the students, the stress of finding time to prepare rich, powerful lessons for their students. Possible solutions: eliminate the redundancy in assessment reports. There's summaries. I mean, there's lots of redundancy that we have to keep repeating in the reports. Instead of requiring short-term objectives on IEPs, allow the IEP team, including the parents, to make a decision on whether or not to include them and just have a goal. This reduces our progress reporting time. And most importantly, increase education funding. Costs continue to increase with no additional funding. In our district alone, with cross-subsidy funding, we are taking $29 million a year cross-subsidy to meet the needs of those students. Funding will also provide the hiring and more staff to meet the needs of our students, such as paraprofessionals, nurses, mental health professionals, such as social workers, and psychologists. I want to teach students with special needs to increase their academic achievement and to improve their emotional and social development and to form relationships that will make a difference in their lives. These students need the specialized instruction we can provide to them to increase their achievement. Please help us help our students. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Aho. Ms. Matthews.
Actually, I'm back. I mean,
sorry. Thank you, Ms. Matthews, Ms. Aho. You're welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I thank you for inviting me to speak with you today. I provide speech-language services to students in a kindergarten through fourth grade elementary building and a ninth through 12th grade high school building. I've been working as a speech-language pathologist for 20 years. I entered the field of special education and speech-language to work with children, help them achieve their potential, and give them a confident voice in the world. Currently, due to my caseload, evaluations, and the amount of paperwork, approximately half of my week is spent on assessments and paperwork, which reduces my student contact time to 2.5 days a week. I am fortunate to have a speech-language pathologist assistant that works with me. I feel she is doing the job I entered the profession thinking I would be doing. I am here to talk to you about special education paperwork and the lack of resources in our school buildings. You will often hear paperwork cited as a reason that prevents special educators like myself from providing the services our kids need and driving talented educators away from the profession. The results of lack of resources, specifically more special education teachers, school counselors, mental health professionals, and paraprofessionals, can be seen affecting students and buildings all across the district which I work. My current caseload consists of 70 students that I provide direct services to. This means, in addition to the speech-language services I provide to these 70 students, I also write all or a portion of 70 individualized education programs, better known as IEPs. In addition to direct students, I also have 13 indirect students who are on my caseload. I am part of their IEP process as well. For all of these students, I write progress notes 2 to 3 times a year. I have been included in approximately 12 evaluations thus far this year. Evaluations provide a deeper knowledge and understanding of the needs of our students, but the reports generated from the evaluation can be laborious to write, overwhelming for parents to comprehend, and redundant in the information that is required to be entered. Due to the fact that speech-language intervention is a medical service, the school district is able to bill certain insurances for my services. This requires me to fill out daily attendance logs and lessons, as well as monthly summaries for students who are eligible for reimbursement. I have 32 students who I bill monthly for. All of this paperwork takes away from the time spent with my students and the time needed to plan enriching lessons to help them succeed. At my elementary school in Brainerd, we have many students move in and out throughout the year. Most of these students remain in the state of Minnesota. However, obtaining and transferring their paperwork can be a tedious process, which prohibits the transferring students from receiving the correct special education services in which they are in need of. A streamlined special education paperwork system across Minnesota would be extremely beneficial to the special education students in the state of Minnesota. If we were able to transfer paperwork between professionals in the state of Minnesota, this would allow for a quicker process, which would ensure students receive the correct and appropriate services and interventions to help them be successful immediately in their new setting. We have a lot to be proud of in regards to public education in Minnesota. In May 2018, U.S. Newsweek ranked the quality of Minnesota's pre-K through 12th grade public education system to be 7th out of the 50 states. That being said, Minnesota's public schools have fewer counselors per students than all but 2 other states, according to a 2015 statistic by the U.S. Department of Education. The American School Counselor Association recommends a 250-to-1 counselor-to-student ratio compared to Minnesota's 792-to-1 counselor-to-student ratio. In the Brainerd District, we do not have school counselors in our elementary schools, and in the middle schools, the counselor-to-student ratio is 667-to-1. Last school year, we lost 2 Brainerd High School students to suicide. In December 2015, one of my third grade students died to suicide. We must do better than what we are currently doing. Our schools are lacking in mental health help that students who are attending our schools are in desperate need of. We need to ensure that there is an appropriate number of counselors in all of our school buildings. Students who walk into our school buildings struggle with mental health issues or problems at home. Who struggle with mental health issues or problems at home are not ready to walk into a classroom and learn. Students demonstrate they are hurting in a variety of ways, and when they are not able to talk with someone, they often shut down or act out. This interferes with their learning, in addition to the learning of the students around them. School is often the safest place these students will be, and we need to make sure we are helping them in every possible way. I feel fortunate to be in the profession I am. I love working with students and seeing their growth throughout the school year. I am lucky to work with many students throughout their elementary education, and I get to see their progress, the progress they make from kindergarten through fourth grade. The amount of special education paperwork that is required for my profession takes time away from my students, reduces my time to collaborate with regular education and other special education teachers, and has me wondering if we'll retain talented special education teachers in this profession. Thank you again for allowing me to speak with you today.
Thank you, Ms. Aho. Is there any questions? Representative Sandel.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. Thank you for the description of your work. The last couple of days, we've heard people talk about independent, or rather intermediate school districts that serve special ed kids and kids with special needs. When would a child with whom you're working be assigned to an intermediate district, and what would be the difference between the people that stay with you and those who are transferred to the intermediate district?
We'd like to take that, Ms. Matthews.
Madam Chair, committee member, in my particular district of District 196, we do not send kids to intermediate districts. We have the services within our district to provide for those students. So my particular district, we're not sending kids to an intermediate district.
Madam Chair, just one quick question. How about the the average size of general ed classrooms, the student-teacher ratio, and how does that compare to the work you're doing?
Madam Chair, committee member, I can tell you that that's one thing that we're looking at is class size in my district and all districts in Minnesota, but I can tell you in my particular elementary school building, the average class size is, 28 to 30. I know that in a particular grade, grade one, which should have lower class size, in my opinion, and I think the legislature agreed with that back when that K-2 funding was put in place, there's 29 kids.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Mary Kunish-Putin.
Thank you. I just want to say thank you very much for the good hard work that both of you do. I'm a teacher of 20-some years and library media specialist, so I do a lot of collaboration with the classrooms and with teachers, and especially around kids that are struggling harder with disability. And I know how hard it is. And when I took this new role as a legislator, one of the first people that came to me were my special ed teachers asking me, please do something about the issues that you are all speaking to, and just know that we are going to try to do our best to make sure that your job does not continue to be such a struggle, and that we are providing the resources that individual children need. So thank you very much, and safe travels home if you're going back to Brainerd.
Thank you.
Yes, I want to thank you too for coming down here. I spent the interim working in a level 3 EBD program and saw firsthand the amount of paperwork that was there. And I would say that I thought about going into special ed, and being a para with all the fun and not the paperwork was a lot easier for me to do. So I can see where the recruitment and the retention mm-hmm. is a big issue. So thank you so much. Quick announcement, we are going to have a joint meeting tomorrow with HHS Policy Committee. Note, it's in room 200, but it's at our regular time. And we're going to do that here about adverse childhood experiences, and then also teacher insights on what that looks like in the classroom. Mr. Benjamin has sent out a link to folks to let you know where you could find the tests so you can look at the ACEs test before our committee time together, if you would like to take it. There wasn't a way to score it, though, so maybe our presenters will be talking about that. And then I also wanted to clear up a little bit of confusion we had last week with the motion around the bill that we had before committee. So as a matter of discretion of the chair, we can have a member of the committee move their own bill when it's already on the agenda. So if it's a scheduled bill and we have them testify, I'll have the member, if it's a member of our committee, I will have them move their own bill, also move their amendment to put the bill in the order that they would like to see it. And then I will be making the final motion. So just wanted to kind of clear that up. And otherwise, I think.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I noticed that the handout we received was question 15 of the Minnesota Special Education Survey. Could you request that we get all of the survey so we could review that, if that's available?
Oh, I see what you're saying. So
yes,
this out here.
This is question 15.
15.
So I presume many questions were asked, maybe 20. If we could see all of the survey questions, the handout.
I see somebody coming down to give us an answer to that.
I figured that was the source.
Thank you.
Yes, please. Can we get copies?
Name for the record, please, and proceed.
Yes, Madam Chair, Jody Poor with Education Minnesota, Representative Erickson, we would be happy to provide you with that entire survey.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you. Good point. Thank you, and with that, we are adjourned.